Today is Monday, May 25th, and it's time to read from the Sioux City Journal. My name is Barb, and I will be your reader today. We're going to review the 5-day forecast, the weather. Then we'll talk about the mini editorial, and followed by front page and inside stories of local interest. So here goes. Today, morning rain, otherwise mostly cloudy, high of 66 today. Perhaps tonight a shower early. Clouds are breaking and a low of 58. Tomorrow, partly sunny. Yay! High of 73. On Wednesday, sunshine, pleasant and warmer, high of 79, as well as on Thursday, high of 79 and partly sunny. Friday, nice with plenty of sun, high of 73. So it looks like a great week ahead. I hope today that amidst the rain, you can enjoy and reflect on our National Memorial Day. Let's talk about the mini editorial. Today's mini is from Jeff Adkins of Sioux City. The politicians are now worrying about the loss of tax revenue. What do they expect when they destroy an economy? This is the opinion of Jeff Adkins of Sioux City. Let's move on now to our top story. Even though it's not local, I will read to you about the holiday weekend drawing crowds. There's a picture of Cocoa Beach, Florida, packed with Memorial Day weekend beachgoers on Saturday. In St. Petersburg, Florida, the Memorial Day weekend, marking the unofficial start of summer in the U.S., meant big crowds at beaches and warnings from authorities Sunday about people disregarding the coronavirus social distancing rules and risking a resurgence of the scourge that has killed nearly 100,000 Americans. Sheriffs, deputies, and beach patrols tried to make sure people kept their distance from others as they soaked up the rays on the sand and at parks and other recreation sites around the country. In the Tampa area along Florida's Gulf Coast, the crowds were so big that authorities took an extraordinary step of closing parking lots before they were full. Pinellas County Sheriff Bob Gulateri said about 300 deputies were patrolling the beaches to ensure people didn't get too close. Also on Sunday, President Donald Trump further limited travel from the world's coronavirus hotspots by denying entry to foreigners coming from Brazil, which is second to the U.S. in the number of confirmed cases. Trump had already banned certain travelers from China, Europe, and the United Kingdom, and Ireland, to a lesser extent, Iran. He has not moved to ban travel from Russia, which has the world's third highest caseload. On the Sunday talk shows, Dr. Deborah Birx, coordinator of the White House Coronavirus Task Force, said she's very concerned about scenes of people crowding together over the weekend. We want to really be clear all the time that social distancing is absolutely critical. And if you can't social distance and you're outside, you must wear a mask, she said on ABC's This Week. In Missouri, people packed bars and restaurants at the Lake of the Ozarks, a vacation hotspot popular with Chicagoans over the weekend. One video showed a crammed pool where vacationers lounged close together without masks. In West Virginia, ATV riders jammed the vast 700-mile Hatfield-McCoy network of all-terrain vehicle trails on the first weekend it was allowed to reopen since the outbreak took hold. Campgrounds and cabins were opened as well. We truly appreciate getting to reopen, Jeff Lusk, director of the Hatfield-McCoy Regional Recreation Authority, told the Charleston Gazette-Mail. Being able to open now will help our trail business recover. In Daytona Beach, Florida, gunfire erupted Saturday night along a beachside road where more than 200 people had gathered and were seen partying and dancing despite the restrictions. Several people were wounded and taken to the hospital. At New York's Orchard Beach in the Bronx, kids played with toys and people sat in folding chairs. Some wore winter coats on a cool and breezy day in which temperatures struggled to reach 60 degrees. Many wore masks and sat apart from others. It's good to be outside with fresh air. Just good to enjoy the outdoors, said Danavin Clacken, whose face was covered. A masked Jennifer Lopez, who wore winter gloves against the chill, said people still make the best out of it. It doesn't matter. I guess during this pandemic, they've been practicing staying at home, staying safe. So now they want to see an opportunity and just want to get out. The U.S. is on track to surpass 100,000 coronavirus deaths in the next few days. While Europe has seen over 169,000 dead, according to a tally by Johns Hopkins University, that almost certainly understates the toll. The New York Times marked the horror by devoting Sunday's entire front page to a long list of names of those who have died in the U.S., the headline, An Incalculable Loss. While Trump went golfing for the second day in a row at his private club in Virginia, he has not played for weeks before this weekend. He said on a syndicated Sunday program, Full Measure with Cheryl Atkinson, that he's feeling fine after taking a two-week course of the unproven drug hydroxychloroquine and a zinc supplement to protect him against the virus, declaring, to the best of the knowledge, of my knowledge, here I am. The president has spent weeks pushing the drug against the advice of many of his administration's top medical professionals. Hydroxychloroquine can have deadly side effects. For the first time in months, the faithful gathered in the Vatican's St. Peter's Square for the traditional Sunday papal blessing, but they kept their distance from one another. Some 2,000 Muslims gathered for Eid al-Fitr prayers at a sports complex in the Paris suburb of Levallois-Perret, spaced 1 meter apart and wearing masks. Beachside communities in England encouraged Londoners and others to stay away after rules were eased to allow people to drive any distance for exercise or recreation. The southern coastal city of Brighton said, "Wish you were here, but not just yet." Wales kept up later tourism campaign, reminding people that its hotels, restaurants, and tourist sites are still closed. Worldwide, more than 5.3 million people have been infected and 342,000 have died, according to the Johns Hopkins tally that experts say undercounts the true toll. Okay, let's go to some local news. Back to the front page. Big picture. I was not expecting a send-off like this. Kylie Lang poses for photos with friends, family, and well-wishers. A Sioux City Fire Rescue firefighter, Lang was gathered with a parade in her honor when she arrived in her hometown of Hinton, Iowa, on Sunday afternoon. A member of the Missouri National Guard, Lang will soon begin an 11-month deployment in Kuwait. Servicewoman gets surprise. Hinton holds event for Lang before her deployment to Kuwait. In Hinton, Iowa, Kylie Lang, age 24, knew something was up when she was greeted by Hinton Police Department squad cars and the Hinton Fire Department trucks on her way back from work Sunday afternoon. A volunteer member of the Hinton Fire Department for the past year and a full-time member of the Sioux City Fire Rescue for the past month, she was expecting to spend a few hours with her family. Instead, a good portion of the town's 941 people greeted Lang with American flags and signs that said, "We will miss you and thank you for your service." "Wow," she said between hugs and kisses from friends, family, and well-wishers, "I was not expecting a send-off like this." Lang, a member of the Missouri National Guard, was slated to report to Fort Leonard Wood, a U.S. Army training installation located in the Ozark Mountains, before beginning an 11-month tour of duty in Kuwait. "Kylie's going to be gone for a while," said her dad, Travis Lang, the organizer of the impromptu parade. "We wanted to show how proud of her we were." Like his daughter, Travis is also a member of the Sioux City Fire Rescue Unit. He admitted to being nervous about his daughter's deployment. "No matter how old she gets, I'll worry about Kylie," he said. "I just know she has a good head on her shoulders." Kylie Lang always wanted to pursue law enforcement as a career, earning a criminology bachelor's degree from Northwest Missouri State University in 2018. She said it was her dad who convinced her to join him as a member of the Sioux City Fire Rescue. "It was absolutely the right decision to make," she said. "I have my family, and I've added my work family." Unfortunately, Lang will have to say goodbye to both for at least a little while. "I'm sort of nervous about going to Kuwait, but really excited. I'll be gaining plenty of experience with the National Guard, and then I'll be able to come back home to a very exciting job." Okay, other stories of local interest. Nebraska economy is better than most. State has third lowest unemployment rate. Nebraska's economy has been devastated by the coronavirus outbreak, and unemployment has surged. But the state has fared better than most of the rest of the nation. The state's unemployment rate for April registered 8.3%, which remains well below the national rate of 14.7%. In Iowa and South Dakota, The April unemployment rate was 10.2%. Nebraska's unemployment rate was the third lowest in the country in those latest figures because the state relies heavily on industries that have not been affected as much by the virus and related government restrictions such as food processing and insurance. The state also does not have as many jobs tied to the hard-hit tourism and oil industries. When you think about it, Nebraska's economy produces a lot of necessities. Food production is essential, and the demand will be there even as people have to cut back. This is Eric Thompson of the University of Nebraska-Lincoln Economist. The insurance, banking, and government sectors have largely been spared job losses. Unemployment figures show that only about one in every 50 workers in those sectors have lost their jobs. In contrast, the downturn from the virus outbreak contributed to the loss of roughly one in every four service jobs. James Blackledge, the CEO of Mutual of Omaha, said his insurance company has not had to lay off any workers so far, and it still expects to add roughly 300 employees by the end of the year. Blackledge said the fact that the company could be adding jobs during the pandemic is remarkable when you think about it. It also helped that Mutual of Omaha has been able to shift most of its employees to working from home instead of coming in to work. Only about 150 of the company's more than 5,000 employees are still currently going into the office. Officials say Nebraska's economy may have also fared better overall during the downturn because the state's social distancing measures weren't as strict as most states imposed. Republican Governor Pete Ricketts was one of only seven governors who never issued a statewide stay-at-home order shutting down all non-essential businesses. Instead, he imposed restrictions on a regional basis throughout the state based on the number of infections and hospitalizations in each area. The idea of shutting down businesses deemed to be non-essential arbitrarily created unemployment in other states, said Brian Sloan, president of the Nebraska Chamber of Commerce. I think Nebraska did it that better. Nebraska has begun to loosen restrictions across the state, which is helping businesses begin to recover. Chrysit Long, who owns two men's hair salons in Omaha, said business has been so good since she's been able to reopen on May 4th that she's employing a few more people than she did before the virus outbreak. We're rebuilding and starting over. That's what it feels like again. We're all super happy to be back at work and taking care of people. State officials said Sunday that Nebraska had almost 12,000 confirmed cases of the coronavirus and 147 deaths since the outbreak. The State Department of Health and Human Services also said that 38% of the state's intensive care beds and 77% of the ventilators remained available on Sunday. Okay, that's it for front page news. Now let's look inside and see what else is going on. This is a quick little release about Elmo. Elmo from Sesame Street. Elmo readies for his own starry talk show. Elmo, bottom left, will host a family-friendly show called The Not Too Late Show with Elmo. It begins streaming Wednesday on HBO Max. There was a time not too long ago when Broadway star Ben Platt was interviewed by a monster. A perfectly nice monster, of course. It was Elmo. Elmo asked Platt what his favorite music was to sing. Cookie Monster interrupted to ask what Platt's favorite cookie was. Oatmeal chocolate chip, he said. Good answer, said Cookie Monster. But then again, there's no such thing as a bad cookie. After a stellar group rendition of the song C is for Cookie, Elmo presented his guest with a placemat. A placemat for Ben Platt, commented Cookie, proud of the rhyme. This meeting of furry monsters and a human singer is part of a new Sesame Workshop family-friendly talk show on HBO called The Not Too Late Show with Elmo. It begins streaming on Wednesday. Other guests include Casey Musgraves, the Jonas Brothers, Miles Brown, Blake Lively, Dan and Shay, Andy Cohen, Hoda Kotb, Josh Groban, Olivia Wilde, Sarah Bareilles, Jason Sudeikis, Sophia Carson, and Sierra. The show is the brainchild of Elmo. Don't tell him differently. And employs his Muppet friends. Cookie Monster is the sidekick. Rosita is the stage manager. And Abby Kadabi is the writer. Various monsters are the directors, riffing on the idea that everyone wants to direct. Throughout the 15-minute duration of the episode, Elmo is talking about one specific bedtime ritual, like putting on your PJs or reading a book or brushing your teeth. Obviously, the whole thing is meant to be playful and a family fun experience, so rather than spend a lot of time talking, we spend more time playing games like hot potato or tic-tac-toe. The talk show business may be ruthless, but late-night hosts Jimmy Fallon and John Olivier make appearances and help sharpen Elmo's interview skills. Elmo challenges Jimmy Fallon to a stare contest, which is not entirely fair since Elmo doesn't have eyelids. During a visit to the Not Too Late show set in New York City before the pandemic shutdown, the technology used was both high-tech and low. Three digital cameras, a teleprompter, and a microphone boom were employed. But a half-moon prop was dangled over Elmo's desk on a pole with a wire, like a fishing gear. A crew member cut fake cookies into a crescent shape. The team putting the show together was able to keep on schedule despite the virus pandemic. Equipment was moved to staffers' homes so post-production editing and sound effects could be done remotely. The show's emphasis on children's nighttime routines comes exactly at a time when parents are looking for stable schedules. Sesame Workshop has also offered helpful resources and activities online during the pandemic. It's an important time to be there for families and kids, so we're trying to do our part as best we can. In an interview after taping Elmo, he said he was having a great time. It's wonderful meeting new people. Elmo gets to meet new guests on the show every day, and he gets to learn about everybody, too. It's wonderful. He said his favorite games include teddy bear dressing races, monster makeovers, freeze dances, and tricycle races. Elmo promised plenty of music, sketches, and games. There's a lot of good stuff in store. You'll see. Kids will love it. So that starts on Wednesday on HBO Max. Other items of local interest. Remembering loved ones. There's a lovely picture of Elson Brown and Mindy Brown clear the grass off Elson's uncle's grave Saturday at Memorial Park Cemetery in Sioux City as they plant the American flags around it. Another picture of Diane Anderson laying flowers at the graves of her husband's parents Saturday at Graceland Park Cemetery in Sioux City. Iowa reports more virus cases and deaths. Iowa health officials are reporting 263 more coronavirus cases and 5 additional deaths related to the virus outbreak in the state. The Iowa Department of Public Health said Sunday there have now been over 17,000 cases of COVID-19 and 449 deaths linked to the virus in the state. The new deaths were reported between Tuesday and Saturday. For some infected people, especially older adults and people with existing health problems, the virus can cause serious illness or death. But for most people, it causes mild or moderate symptoms such as fever and cough that clear up in 2 to 3 weeks. South Dakota reports new COVID-19 cases, but no deaths. South Dakota health officials reported 95 new confirmed cases of COVID-19 on Sunday, but no new deaths tied to the coronavirus. Health officials said 3,260 of the state's 4,500 coronavirus cases have been reported in Minnehaha County, which is South Dakota's most populous county, and the location of a large outbreak at the pork processing plant. Health officials said the number of deaths tied to the coronavirus remained at 50 on Sunday. The number of hospitalized patients was 85 on Sunday, down 5 from the previous day. A total of 364 cases have required hospitalization. Over 3,300 people have recovered from the coronavirus in South Dakota. Health officials warned the actual number of infections is higher because many people may not display symptoms or have not sought testing for mild symptoms. Do you know the number of soldiers that are buried in Arlington National Cemetery? It's 400,000. A lovely picture is here of two soldiers that are placing flags beside each one of the monuments at Arlington Cemetery. Lives lost, the U.S. Armed Services deaths from the Revolutionary War through post-9/11 Gulf War area. 656,000 veterans have died in battle. 552,000 veterans have died in service, but were not in battle. So that's over 1.3 million vets who have died. Currently, we have 1.366 million active duty service members. The average age, the median age, is 27 years old, and out of 1 in 3 service members live in military housing. Their average length of service is 6.4 years, and 52% of active duty service members are married. What's the holiday history? Memorial Day, originally called Decoration Day, is a day of remembrance for those who have died in service to their country. The holiday was officially proclaimed in 1868 to honor Union and Confederate soldiers and was expanded after World War I to honor those who died in all wars. In 1971, Congress declares Memorial Day a national holiday to be celebrated the last Monday in May. Today, Memorial Day honors over 1 million men and women who have died in military service since the Civil War. How to display the flag. On Memorial Day, the flag should be flown at half-mast from sunrise until noon only, then raised briskly to the top of the staff until sunset in honor of the nation's battle heroes. For the first time in 20 years, AAA said it will not issue a Memorial Day weekend travel forecast due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Last year, 43 million Americans traveled for Memorial Day weekend, the second highest travel volume on record since AAA began tracking volumes in 2000. With social distancing guidelines still in practice, this holiday's weekend travel volume is likely to set a record low. On the celebration side, 818 hot dogs are eaten every second between Memorial Day and Labor Day. Wow, that's a lot of hot dogs. $1.5 billion is the average sale of meat and seafood in that time frame. And about 60% of the people plan to grill out. Red poppies are recognized as the Memorial Day flower. And Taps is the song often played at Memorial Day celebrations. Moments of Remembrance. A national moment of remembrance takes place at 3 p.m. local time on Memorial Day to honor veterans with a moment of silence. Okay, we'll move on to other news. We don't have any local obituaries in today's Sioux City Journal edition, but there is an obituary in here for a legendary coach who went to the Final Four with 3 teams, and that is Eddie Sutton, age 84. Eddie Sutton waited so long to be inducted into the Naismith Memorial Basketball Hall of Fame. He couldn't hang on long enough to make it to the ceremony. The man who led 3 teams to the Final Four and was the first coach to take 4 schools to the NCAA tournament died Saturday. He was 84. Sutton's family said in a statement he died of natural causes in his home in Tulsa, Oklahoma. His wife, Patsy, died in 2013. He cherished the time he spent at every school and appreciated the support of their loyal fans, said the family. Elected to the Naismith Memorial Basketball Hall of Fame on April 3rd, Sutton fell short as a finalist 6 times before finally being selected. He said he believed that a scandal that ended his stint at Kentucky was likely the culprit for his lengthy wait. The NCAA announced 18 allegations against the program in 1988, and he resigned in 1989. But he certainly had a worthy resume. Sutton compiled a 368 wins and 151 losses mark in the 16 seasons he was head coach at Oklahoma State, and an 806-329 record in 37 seasons overall, not counting vacated victories or forfeited games, made it to 25 NCAA tournaments. He led Final Four squads at Arkansas in 1978 and Oklahoma State in 1995 and 2004. He took Creighton, Arkansas, Kentucky, and OSU to the national tournament. He was Associated Press Coach of the Year in 1978 at Arkansas and 1986 in Kentucky. Sutton's retirement at Oklahoma State in 2006 came roughly 3 months after he took a medical leave following a traffic accident that resulted in charges of aggravated DUI, speeding, and driving on the wrong side of the road. Through it all, he remained wildly popular at Oklahoma State, often attending games while confined to a wheelchair. In other sports news, Woods, Manning deliver win. Tom Brady, there's a picture of Tom Brady playing his shot from the 8th tee during Sunday's charity match in Hobie Sound, Florida. Tom Brady provides a shot of the match with a 130-yard birdie to quiet the hecklers. Tom Brady delivered the shot of the match that made it easy to forget the rest of his swings. Tiger Woods didn't miss a fairway and earned a small measure of revenge against Phil Mickelson. The PGA Tour is set to return in just over 2 weeks and has a tough act to follow. In the second and final charity match that brought live golf to TV, this exhibition was as entertaining as the real thing. Woods lagged a long birdie putt close enough that his partner Peyton Manning didn't even have to putt. That secured a one-up victory over Mickelson and Brady in the match, Champions for Charity. The goal was to raise $10 million or more for COVID-19 relief funds, and online donations sent money climbing to twice that much. Woods and Mickelson played a $9 million winner-take-all match in Las Vegas over Thanksgiving weekend in 2018 that Mickelson won, but the event felt forced and lacked banter. Throw in two NFL greats in Brady and Manning, and this allowed viewers to ride along for 18 holes at the Medalist Golf Club among four of the biggest stars in sports. Justin Thomas pitched in as an on-course reporter, bringing a mixture of humor and insight with the right amount of words. Woods and Manning took the lead on the third hole and never trailed, building a three-up lead in four balls on the front nine, with Manning making two birdies. Brady, whose six Super Bowl titles are more than any NFL quarterback in history, took a beating on social media and in the broadcast booth from Charles Barkley, who twice offered $50,000 of his own money toward charity if Brady would just hit the green on a par three. He missed so far right it would be comparable to a pass that landed three rows into the stands. Brooks Koepka offered $100,000 if Brady could just make a par. One shot shut everyone up. Never mind that Brady had to take a penalty drop before getting back to the fairway on his par 5 seventh. With his fourth shot from 130 yards, Barkley was needling him relentlessly, and Brady's shot landed beyond the pin and spun back into the cup. "Shut your mouth, Chuck," said Brady, whose microphone piece dangled off the back of his pants, which he split on the hole. Woods still thought he won the hole with a 25-foot eagle putt that instead spun hard off the back of the lip. All that, and they ended up having the hole. Mickelson brought out his Tiger Slayer putter that he used to shoot 64 at Pebble Beach in 2012, and the last time they were in the final group on the PGA Tour. Woods shot a 75 that day. It didn't help Lefty with a few critical birdie putts to square the match, though he rolled in a 15-foot par putt to stay one down with two to play. All right, we'll continue on with just a couple other things in the Sioux City, today's Sioux City Journal. Then we're going to go back and read a few things from yesterday. Today's birthdays include Ralph Waldo Emerson. He was born in 1803 and died in 1882. He was a very famous poet, essayist, and philosopher. Bilbo Jangles Robinson, a dancer and actor, birthday was today, 1878 to 1949. Gene Tunney, a boxer, was born in 1897 and lived to 1978. Robert Ludlum, an author, wrote a lot of mystery books, 1927 to 2001. Another author, Raymond Carver, born in 1938 and died in 1988. Ian McKellen, an actor, was born in 1939 and lives on today. Mike Myers, an actor. Anne Hesch, an actor. Octavia Spencer, an actress, and Cillian Murphy, an actor, all have birthdays today. Allie Reisman, 1994, U.S. gymnast who won several team gold medals, is just 26 years old today. I know you do hear Dear Abby from some others, but I am going to read a few of the entries today. Man has nonchalant attitude about locking up at night. Dear Abby, my husband has a bad habit of forgetting to lock up our house at night when he's the last one to come to bed. On 9 occasions, I've gone downstairs after he's in bed or awakened in the morning to find our sliding door, patio door, or garage door unlocked. I can't understand why this is not a priority for him. If I'm the last one to come up at night, I make sure each door is locked, lights are off. Takes me less than a minute. We live in a suburb, and while our neighborhood is relatively safe and quiet, I am not naive. I realize anything can happen anywhere. We have two large dogs, but I have no idea how they'd react to an intruder. Frankly, I don't want to find out the hard way. The most frustrating thing about this is when I try to talk to him about it the next day, he blows it off and says our dogs would never let anyone get far, and he makes a joke about it. I've tried several different approaches, from being calm and sweet to solutions focused. How can I help you remember? Recently, likely because I'm 37 weeks pregnant with our second child, I lost it and I chewed him out after I waddled out of bed to go downstairs and found our sliding door unlocked. Needless to say, it didn't work very well. I'm at wit's end. It's the one thing when it was just the two of us, but now we're about to have two kids under two, and I get furious thinking he'll be putting us all in danger. He has taken no responsibility or steps toward fixing this. I now have reached the conclusion that when I'm home, I must be the one who assumes the responsibility of ensuring our home is secure before we go to bed. But what if I fall asleep early and I have to travel for work? Any ideas how to address this with him? Signed, Losing Sleep Over This. Dear Losing, you've already addressed this with your husband. That he's so careless about the safety of his wife and children is shocking. He appears to be very immature. Because he seems incapable of assuming responsibility for locking up, you're just going to have to do it. There are high-tech ways to remotely lock doors from afar, and you should explore that option. As for your own peace of mind, have a professional dog trainer or other experienced dog person enter your home through the unlocked door while you and your husband are upstairs. Because while the dogs may not attack a stranger, they may alert you to the presence of an intruder. I suggest this because many years ago, my very tame German Shepherd did exactly that. Dear Abby, due to the coronavirus epidemic, handshaking is no longer being practiced. I've never been a fan of handshaking anyway. In the future, it may be acceptable to forgo handshaking altogether. What will be the best way to avoid it without seeming unfriendly or germophobic? Dear Resistance, try doing what I do. I place both palms together in front of my chest as though praying. Smile and greet the person. No one has been offended by it, and it's a common way people greet each other in India. Continuing on, another story of interest, although it is not local. Bus lines see road to ruin without federal help. In Lewiston, Maine, the nation's 3,000 or so private bus lines and the millions of people who rely on them for cheap basic travel fret that they'll go under without the same kind of federal help trains and planes are enjoying as the pandemic immobilized America tries to get back to work and play. Buses are integral to the transit network, serve a multitude of purposes as they shuttle around 600 million people annually, nearly twice the U.S. population. They take college students home for the weekend, take businessmen and tourists to airports, and on fall color tours. They take gamblers and sports fans to casinos and stadiums. They provide charter trips and are also increasingly vital to the work commute, especially in congested areas like San Francisco and New York City. They employ about 100,000 people, many of whom are furloughed at the moment, and generate more than $200 billion in travel and tourism revenue, according to the American Bus Association. More than 95% of the nation's private fleet is shut down, said Peter Pentuso, the trade group's leader. Larry Prell of National Park, New Jersey, had hoped to take the megabus to the National Cherry Blossom Festival in the nation's capital, but pandemic restrictions canceled both the bus and the festival. I know some of them are not surviving the shutdown. A couple down here that were charter buses are just gone. They'll never be seen from again. Rail lines, public transit systems, and the airline industry received billions in aid as part of the U.S. Federal Coronavirus Relief Act. The private bus industry, however, has been largely left to fend for itself. The industry has called on the government to provide $15 billion in grants and loans to help it weather the stay-at-home orders that have idled their businesses and their buses for 2 months. I think there's going to be several companies, if not dozens or hundreds, that 6 months from now are going to run out of money and are not going to have any other options to weather the storm. Buses play a key role in the economy because of support they provide to other businesses, such as hotels. Restaurants, attractions, and tour group destinations rely on them to shuttle large numbers of people around unfamiliar areas while on vacation. They take college sports teams and game day fans who spend money on everything from tickets to beer to and from their destinations. Bus operators have lobbied Congress and rallied this month in Washington, drawing more than 1,000 motor coaches from as far as the West Coast. Senators Susan Collins, a Maine Republican, and Jack Reed, a Rhode Island Democrat, have called on Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin to provide assistance. The industry, the senators say, faces a long road to recovery and is missing out at a critical time. School, camp, and tour groups in the spring and summer are reliable customers, and those activities are largely canceled this year. We must ensure that the motor coach industry is still there for our communities when this pandemic has passed. A spokesperson for the Treasury Department did not respond to a request for comment. In Maine, Northeast Charter of Lewiston, which operates 27 motor coaches, 25 school buses, and another 10 shuttle buses, has not had any business since March 16th. Every booking since then has been canceled, said owner Scott Riccio, who participated in the Washington rally. The same goes for all June trips, he said, and many are ready for July, August, and September. While other transportation sectors can get federal grants and loans, bus lines have only the Paycheck Protection Program, he said. That program, which helps keep workers on the payroll, will eventually run out. If help doesn't arrive soon, the industry fears many companies will go under, creating a transportation vacuum that would be hard to fill and depriving the public of a cheap travel option. This industry is being devastated. There's no one working. There's no revenue. Zero. And I'm going to continue on with a travel story called On the Road Again, How the American Road Trip Will Change Going Forward. Few things having to do with travel will be unchanged in the post-corona world, but of all the ways we travel, the all-American road trip may be least affected, at least from a regulatory standpoint. No one will tell you to wear a mask or to take your temperature or demand blood work before you hit the road this summer, but questions abound about this American institution, including whether it's safe, at least safer than airline travel. Here's what your road trip of the future may look like. The question is driving safer than flying? People are increasingly looking at car trips for their vacation plans. According to data from MMGY Travel Intelligence in partnership with the U.S. Travel Association, in a survey taken April 17th through 22nd, 47% of the respondents said they would be more likely to travel by car, an increase from 35% in data collected April 4th through 11th. For all travelers, safety is a priority, and many are asking whether driving is safer than flying these days. In terms of the coronavirus, probably, said Robert Winters, a Southern California infectious disease specialist. If traveling with others in a car, one would assume you know the person that's sitting next to you and you know their health status, Winters said in an email. Car travel has to be safer than airline travel. When you factor in controlled boarding, exiting processes, number of people on an airplane, unknown health status of people on the flight, uncooperative children sitting near you, etc. In terms of crashes, planes are safer. In 2019, about 39,000 people died in automobile accidents, according to the National Safety Council. Airline crashes caused 257 deaths that year, according to 270's Aviation Review. Here's a checklist of things before you leave. Number one, check your car. Do your car's regular pre-trip check, tires especially, that AAA recommends, noting that getting stranded may have greater consequences because of reduced service. Number two, check conditions at your destination to ensure that you're not hitting a hotspot. The CDC and Prevention offers a map that shows hotspots and provides data at bit.ly/coronavirus hotspots. Number three, double check whether the state you're heading to has self-quarantine in effect. Although federal law cannot bar you from traveling to a state, local authorities can require self-quarantine for as many as 14 days. To check whether the state you're planning to visit has such a regulation, call the state health authority from a list provided by the CDC, bit.ly/state health departments. Number four, bring personal protection equipment. Pack masks and gloves for all riders, Winters said, and make provisions for hand washing, sanitizer. Bring your own soap and sanitizer. Disinfectant wipes are a must. Number 5, ask a doctor. Check in with your health care provider, AAA suggests, especially if your passengers are older or have medical issues. Number 6, bring snacks. Pack a cooler with drinks and snacks, including high-protein goodies that will not go bad, to reduce the number of stops. Number 7, clean your car. About a third of the drivers clean the inside of their car only about once a year, said Cheryl Conley, a futurist who studies global consumer trends for the Ford Motor Company, adding that the steering wheel is generally 4 times dirtier than a restroom. Besides that high touch point, clean safety belts, door handles, and even the fob you use to start the car. In the future, cars may have antimicrobial surfaces, she said. The CDC offers suggestions on how to sanitize your home, many of which are applicable to the car. Bleach or cleaning solutions with bleaching agents should not be used on surfaces such as carpeting that are not color fast. Number 8. Pack plenty of charging cords and perhaps external batteries for electronic devices. If your navigation system contains emergency calling, enable that as well. Number 9. Plan like a demon. You don't want to wing it, especially for hotels, restaurants, or rest areas. Don't rely on websites, said Bill Cleven, a travel broadcaster and writer who travels to 50 or 60 destinations a year as he helps travelers rediscover America. If you're planning on making a pit stop or two along your route, call to make sure the restaurant or rest area is actually going to be open. Some will have shut down for good or will have had hour changes. This is particularly true in places that have relied solely on travel traffic away from more populated areas. Number 10, read the fine print. Understand the lodging's cancellation rules. Make sure the hotel or rental property you book has an ironclad refund policy. Major hotels seem to have been very reasonable, but still ask. Booking directly with the hotel may spare you some back and forth with a third-party site if something goes wrong. The rest stop. Calling ahead to make sure your favorite rest stop is open is a good idea. You'll also want to take an occasional break and avoid driving drowsy, which accounted for more than 100,000 accidents in 2019, according to the National Safety Council. Further, the CDC notes that many thousands of Americans report short sleep, that is, getting less than 7 hours a night. Add to that the stress of recent events that's keeping us awake, and it's a formula for falling asleep at the wheel. So by all means, stop, pull over, take a snooze. But before using the restroom, consider the grunge factors. You need a restroom with soap and hot water, two forceful combatants against the coronavirus. Create a restroom break kit for each person traveling with you, small bar of soap, paper towels for drying and avoiding high-touch handles, travel-sized packs of toilet seat covers, including hand sanitizer and wipes for when soap and water are not available. If you're at a gas station, consider the restroom break after you pump gas and wash your hands before and after. If only pumping gas, gloves are a good idea. Dispose in the nearby trash containers, not on the ground. Are we overreacting? Possibly. But in this age of the coronavirus, we must act as though our life depends on the precautions we take. Are you interested in visiting a park? The National Park Service is increasing access in a phased approach across all units of the National Park System. Before visiting a park, please check nps.gov/findapark to determine the operating status. When visiting an open park, consider these guidelines from the CDC. Do things to do. Visit parks that are close to your home. Traveling long distances to visit a park may contribute to the spread of COVID-19. As most travel requires you to stop along the way or be in close contact with others. And travel may also expose you to surfaces contaminated with a virus that causes COVID-19. Prepare before you visit. State or local park authorities will decide whether parks and other recreation facilities will open. Check with the park in advance to make sure you know which areas or services are open, such as bathroom facilities and concessions, and bring what you need. In the national parks, the National Park Service will decide on a park-by-park basis whether a national park will be open. Please check with individuals for specific details, since in many cases, visitor centers, concessions, and bathroom facilities may be closed. Beaches or other swimming areas. State and local authorities will decide whether natural bodies of water and beaches or swim areas will be open. Play it safe around swimming pools and keep space between yourself and others. There is no evidence that COVID-19 can be spread to humans through the water. Proper operation, maintenance, and disinfection with chlorine or bromine of pools should kill COVID-19. Don't visit parks if you're sick or recently exposed to COVID-19. Don't visit crowded parks. Don't use the playgrounds. And don't participate in organized activities or sports. So these are some good tips for travel in the summer months ahead. Again, today is Monday, May 25th, 2020. My name is Barb, and I thank you for joining me in the reading of the Sioux City Journal. Today, a little bit rainy and on and off showers, and the rest of the week looks lovely, starting with Tuesday, high of 73, and then as we continue through the week, higher upper 70s and some sunshine. Enjoy your week, stay healthy, and stay home when possible. Thanks for joining me.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is EarthDate. Since the dawn of humankind, people have used caves to explore, hold religious ceremonies, create art, or avoid the dangers of weather and predators. Partly because of that, they continue to fascinate scientists today. To create a cave, Mother Nature needs three things: water, rock that can be dissolved by it, and lots of time. Rainwater, as it falls through the atmosphere, picks up carbon from CO2 to become a weak carbonic acid. By the time it hits Earth, it's about as acidic as coffee. As it percolates through the soil, it picks up more carbon from decaying plants, becoming a slightly stronger acid. If the rock below the soil is limestone, gypsum, or dolomite, the water can dissolve along tiny cracks. Over many thousands of years, the cracks become channels, then tunnels, and could eventually become caverns. Water might also mix with hydrogen sulfide gas seeping up from natural oil and gas deposits to form sulfuric acid, which can also dissolve the rock. Protected from daily and seasonal changes on the surface, caves can maintain a stable temperature and humidity. In these delicate environments, the remains of ancient animals and humans, which could have quickly decayed on the surface, have been preserved for millennia. Deeper, more isolated caves have preserved bacteria and microbes undisturbed for millions of years. These qualities make caves important sites for researchers, natural time capsules. There's probably an amazing cave near you, so take a trip and get to know your Earth. I'm Scott Tinker, dissolving mysteries on EarthDate.
EarthDate is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more EarthDate stories at earthdate.org.
This is Tom Hatton with an Irish short take from the book A Culinary History of Iowa. Article we're reading now is entitled Manna Colonies Maintain Rich History in Iowa. The Icarians weren't the only communal society to play a role in Iowa's culinary history. The famous manna colonies in eastern Iowa were also founded on communal principles, but unlike the Icarians, the Mannas had a strong religious component. By the 1700s, people across northern Europe had become dissatisfied with the rituals and intellectualism of the Lutheran Church and had begun to rebel and separate from the Church. Adherence to a new faith called the Community of True Inspiration form their own self-reliant communities. Known as the Inspirationists, these men and women and their families found refuge in central Germany. Persecution and an economic depression in Germany in the 1830s, however, forced the community to search for a new home. Hundreds of Inspirationists immigrated to America in 1843 to 44 in search of religious freedom. They pooled their resources and established a community named Ebenezer near modern-day Buffalo, New York. All property was held in common. Farms and factories were established, and the community of nearly 1,200 people prospered. When more farmland was needed for the growing community, the Inspirationists looked to Iowa, where attractively priced land was available. A committee was sent to inspect land in Iowa in the mid-1850s. The Iowa River Valley proved particularly promising. Here, the men found acres of rich soil, good timber, water, limestone, sandstone, and clay necessary for establishing a new community. The leaders chose the name Amana, meaning remain true, from Song of Solomon 4:8. Starting in 1855, six villages were established a mile or two apart, including Amana, East Amana, West Amana, South Amana, High Amana, and Middle Amana. The village of Homestead was added in 1861, giving the Amana colonies access to the railroad. Each village had its own school, farm, and craft industries to make it virtually self-sufficient. The communal way of life was continued in Amana, much like it had been in Ebenezer. All property was held in common. Families were assigned housing in buildings owned by the Amana Society. Each individual worked at a designated job. Religious life was the strong unifying factor. In the seven villages, residents received a home, medical care, meals, all household necessities, and schooling for their children. Property and resources were shared. Men and women were assigned jobs by the village council of brethren. No one received a wage. Farming and the production of wool and calico supported the community. But village enterprises, from clockmaking to brewing, were vital. While crafted products became a hallmark of the Amana colonies, which are still known for exceptional wines and more. People were called to work before dawn by the gentle tolling of the bell in the village tower in Old Amana, where the pace of life was much different than today. More than 50 communal kitchens provided three daily meals, as well as mid-morning and mid-afternoon snacks to all colonists. These kitchens were operated by the women of the Amana colonies and were well supplied by the village smokehouse, bakery, ice house, and dairy, as well as the orchards, vineyards, and huge communal gardens maintained by the villagers. During the growing season, there was plenty of work to do in the gardens and kitchens, from planting and harvesting to preparing and storing vegetables, from cabbage to turnips. Around 1900, for example, it wasn't unusual for the communal kitchens in just one Amana village to produce more than 400 gallons of sauerkraut. It took a lot of food and labor to sustain the villages within the Amana colonies. Children attended school 6 days a week, year-round, until age 14. Boys were then assigned jobs on the farm or in the craft shops, while girls were assigned to a communal kitchen or garden. Work and faith were often intertwined and were intertwined in the villages, where the Inspirationists attended worship services 11 times per week. Times were changing by the early 20th century, however. Improved communications and transportation in the 1920s began to exert their influence on the Amana colonies. In addition, the collapse of the American economy following the stock market crash of October 1929 left no aspect of daily life untouched. The Great Depression and disastrous farm economy made the isolated communal life in Amana socially and economically impossible. In the early 1930s, Amana set aside its communal way of life. A strong desire on the part of the residents to maintain their community finally propelled the change, according to Amana history shared by the Amana Colonies Convention and Visitors Bureau. By 1932, the communal way of life was seen as a barrier to achieving individual goals. Rather than leave or watch their children leave the community, the people of the Amana villages changed. Members voted to abandon the communal system and establish the Amana Society Incorporated, a profit-sharing corporation to manage the farmland, mills, and larger enterprises. Private enterprise was encouraged. While this separated the economic aspect of the community from the church, the Amana Church Society continued to be the religious foundation of the community. Today, the seven villages of the Amana colonies are among the state's most popular tourist attractions. Declared a National Historic Landmark in 1965, the Amana colonies attract hundreds of thousands of visitors annually who come to experience a place where the past is cherished and hospitality is a way of life. The streets of the Amana colonies, lined with their historic brick, stone, and clapboard houses, their flower and vegetable gardens, and their lanterns and walkways, recall the Amana of yesterday. Many museums are available for tours, including the communal kitchen in Middle Amana, preserved just as it was on the day in 1932 when the last communal meal was served in the colony. The communal kitchen lets you step back in time. Guides explain kitchen routines and share insights on communal life. Guests can also enjoy a satisfying taste of Amana history and hospitality at the famous Ox Yoke Inn, a full-service restaurant founded in 1940 in the village of Amana. The Ox Yoke Inn's nationally recognized reputation of fresh, quality food served family style reflects the restaurant's old-world signature dishes. The Ox Yoke Inn serves traditional German and American favorites at breakfast, lunch, and dinner, as well as on Sunday brunch buffet. Glimpses of the past are also preserved in some of the gardens in the Amana colonies. With the passing of the old order in 1932, the number of the society's large vegetable gardens and orchards dwindled, but Larry Reddick and his wife Wilma still grow some of the colony's heirloom varieties in their fourth-generation South Amana vegetable garden. In 1980, they founded a seed bank to preserve heirloom plants for the future generations. In his 2013 book, Gardening the Amana Way, Reddick's chapters on modern vegetable and flower gardening in today's Amana colonies showcase his cottage in the meadow gardens, now listed with the Smithsonian's Archives of American Gardens. Old intermingles with new across Reddick's gardens as heirloom lettuce keeps company with the latest cucumber variety. It's a living tribute to the unique history of Amana colonies and one of America's longest-lived communal societies. And that was an excerpt from A Culinary History of Iowa by Darcy Doherty, Malsey, and Other Offbeat Stuff by Eric Jones, Dan Coffey, and Barrett Thorkelson.